Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Lancin. If we were to believe the news or the hype that accompanies the releases of new consumer technologies, we could understand that virtual reality is a profoundly new experience that may yet redefine our understanding of the real reality that we already occupy. Indeed, such metaphysical approaches seem to be at the core of the multiverses that we have recently been promised. In The Aesthetics of Virtual Reality, Grant Taverner proposes that this account of VR is fundamentally mistaken, suggesting that instead, an analysis of VR as a picturing medium and its uses should lead their aesthetic investigation. Grant Taverner is senior lecturer in philosophy at Lincoln University in New Zealand. He has published widely on the aesthetics of video games, virtual worlds, digital media and ethics, and the philosophy of technology. And I'm very happy that he joins me now. Welcome to the show, Grant.
It's great to be here. I'm great to talk to you.
Let's step into the New Books Network multiverse. So, donning on our headsets, I'd like to start by asking you how it is that you came to be interested in the topic of virtual reality and why its aesthetics has been so urgent and so important for you to explore. And I gather that you have been interested in the realm of computer games for quite some time. So it would be interesting to know how that might have fed into your research.
I've been writing about video games for the last maybe 20 years, and I come out of the philosophy of the arts, so I treat video games as an art form and ask some of the traditional questions that we might ask about art forms about video games. So how do we perceive them? What are their emotional resonances for us? What are their distinctive forms and modes of aesthetic appreciation and that type of thing? And the concern with virtual reality sort of grows quite naturally out of that concern because, there are now VR video games. It's a new medium for presenting that form. But it goes beyond that as well because, of course, there are other non-video game uses of VR that are particularly interesting. There are scientific uses, increasingly therapeutic uses. And I find this all, very interesting. And more basically, philosophically, VR is obviously very interesting because it connects with a lot of the traditional issues that we find in philosophy, such as metaphysics and perception, that style of thing.
We'll get to quite a lot of these big questions in the course of our conversation, but I think I'd like you to start us off relatively gently. And you do that in a book by describing one of your first, if not your first, experience of using virtual reality in a game. I think the game might have been Resident Evil, and I thought that was a really good way to bring our listeners into thinking about some of the things that questions of virtual reality might bring.
Resident Evil is a reasonably traditional video game in which you explore a haunted house. There's something mysterious going on there and it's dark and there are monsters and you don't really know what you're going to encounter. Mm-hmm. And I've never really found horror video games all that scary. But on the PS4 virtual reality headset, it was so scary I couldn't actually play it. I had to give up. And it had to do with sort of feeling vulnerable in the space. And one of the things about VR is that things are happening around you. It's not just on a screen in front of you. And you feel vulnerable for things that might be sort of lurking in the shadows. And you feel hesitant about moving into the space And, you know, it's just an overwhelming impression that you get. And it seems to sort of touch on what's regarded as the special realism of VR, that it seems real in a way that other media don't in some sense. And it gives this sort of deep emotional connection to what's happening in the world.
Well, let's dwell a little bit on the special sense of reality. Earlier today, I came across an advert from the 1990s for Tamagotchi, the little toys, which were at the time billed as the first ever virtual reality toy. And of course, there's clearly quite a lot of scope between that definition of virtuality and the kind of idea we get when we think about the dizzying heights and the possibilities of the metaverse.
So I think that term, you know, virtual itself is so prevalent these days that it's ambiguous, you know, thoroughly ambiguous about what it's referring to. And it's used as sort of a buzzword. We have virtual meetings and virtual teaching and all this sort of stuff. And it seems like sometimes it's just a replacement for computer or online or networked. Whereas I try to use in a more specific sense, talking about virtual reality headsets, which I think are a mode of picturing, you know, of feeling yourself in another location. And I discussed that technology early on in the book. But I agree that virtual is just a very widely used term. Virtual reality headsets go back to at least the 1980s, I guess, even the 1970s, the prospect that there could be this thing. But it's really only come into sort of commercial fruition in the last 10 years, I'd say. And the reason it's so popular now, of course, is because companies like Facebook and PlayStation are producing viable headsets. So it's a reasonably modern development, but I argue in the book, actually, that it goes much, much further back. And that virtual reality is just basically a picturing technology, and that attempts to sort of virtualize experience can be seen in Renaissance art in particular, in the use of linear perspective. The people who created that, such as Alberti and Brunelleschi, they thought they were trying to bring about a way to experience pictures as one would experience the world. They thought they were a technological development that we might see as sort of as virtual these days.
Well, that's a strand in the book that I found particularly fascinating, because you go into history of art in a way that I would not have necessarily expected in this book. And you use that to make a very crucial point about virtual reality as we commonly understand it now, as you just said, not necessarily being the invention it purports to be. But I think to do that, it would be good to go through some of the steps of the argument in the book. And I have to say, I was overwhelmed, and I really appreciated the amount of technical work that you did in the book, and technical both in a sense of discussing technology, but also through going through a variety of arguments that might be imposed on a reading of virtual reality.
So I think the predominant way in which virtual reality has been tackled recently, and especially by philosophers, is in a metaphysical way, you know, asking about the reality of virtual worlds or virtual objects, or whether it's valuable to be engaged in virtual worlds and objects, and what exactly we're perceiving, and those style of questions. And I think that this is a fundamentally wrong approach, because it ignores what virtual reality is in itself as a medium. And it tends to treat virtual reality as being a prop to discuss older philosophical questions, such as, Cartesian fictions and the reality of the external world, idealism, and those style of things. And what is lost in that is what virtual reality as a medium is actually doing. And so I wanted to really get into the technical details of what is going on when we perceive a virtual reality world through a headset. And I think that once we have that technical understanding, then it undermines a lot of those other metaphysical approaches. It shows that they're not really getting to the heart of what virtual reality is doing. And it obscures a lot of other interesting philosophical stuff that we might talk about.
So, well, let's get into it. Let's talk about the virtual medium. First, I guess we have to figure out what a medium is, and that should be relatively straightforward. But then we might want to discuss what virtuality is. And that already is where a lot of disagreements, I think, start emerging.
Yeah, so in I think the second chapter, I discuss those two concepts, virtuality and media, and to try and work out individually what they are. You know, I'm an analytic philosopher, so I tend to analyze things into their component parts. And it's not such a simple question to understand what a medium is. And I think often it's been sort of glossed over what a medium is and what it means in terms of virtual media or artistic media. So I have a discussion there, and I bring out various senses and what medium means. And I think the relevant sense in virtual media is that a medium is a means of doing something, or a physical way of conveying some functional purpose or some sort of physical event. So things can be instantiated in media, and they can move from one medium to another. So for example, storage media, which is a computational idea, things might move from one given storage medium to another. And what's happening there is that the function, the information that's being invested in one medium might be invested in the second medium. So what I basically think a medium is a means of doing something or conveying something or instantiating something. And an individual thing can be instantiated in more than one medium, and it might move between media. And that brings about the question then, is what is being instantiated in a virtual medium? What is it that virtual media do? So to answer that question, we need to look at what virtual means. And that's another question which really hasn't been answered in any great depth. I think there's a lot of literature that sort of dances around the issue, but doesn't address it in a direct way. So Peirce and Deleuze address this issue, but not in a really full way that informs the current discussion. So I give an analysis of what we might mean by virtual. And if I can remember it now, it's the idea...
That's the crucial bit, Grant. That's the one I really need to remember.
Okay. Take a virtual war. We might think that the Cold War is a virtual war. And what we mean by that is that it's not an actual war in the sense of being two forces on the battlefield fighting each other. Rather, it preserves the function of that actual war in a non-customary way. So it leaves out some of the things that we find in actual wars, such as direct confrontation between two armies, but instantiates the function of war in a sort of a non-customary way. And in the case of the Cold War, it was by using proxy forces fighting battles for the main combatants, or using other means of fighting wars or achieving the political aims of wars. So if that's an example of virtuality, then we might look for other examples, that we have today, such as a virtual store. Instantiates the function of a store, but does it in a non-customary way. Mm-hmm. So rather than having bricks and mortar, what it does is it puts it on a website. And it gains certain things by putting the store on a website, because you don't have to, employ customer service people, and you don't have to pay rent in a high street and that style of thing. But it preserves the function that you really want to achieve by that. So virtuality seems like it's a non-customary way of achieving a precedent function.
So I think the two examples you just gave are particularly interesting, because they do not in any obvious way connect to the kind of common understanding of virtual reality that we might have. And that brings me to two quite interesting points that you made in the book. One is that virtuality does not have to be computational per se. Wars are not necessarily computational. And the second one is that virtuality is not in and of itself connected with fiction. So again, a virtual store does not have to be a fictional in any particular sense. So this, I think, places us at odds with the received idea that virtual reality is a profoundly technological advancement.
So I think given the way that I analyze virtuality, it turns out that virtual things don't have to be computational things. And in fact, virtuality is much more common in cultural development than we might think. So it happens when any given function or object finds itself in a different media, is remediated in a non-customary way. Mm-hmm. So we find sort of non-computational virtuality. Whereas what we probably think we're talking about when we talk about virtual these days is computational virtuality, which is like a species of virtuality. And I think the contribution that virtuality makes to cultural development is it allows cultural forms or practices or objects to exploit the common technology of the particular time. So we have computers these days, the development of the last 50 years mostly, and there are previous practices such as commercial practices or social practices that we can instantiate in this new medium, computers. And it amounts to a remediation of those practices. I think a good example of a non-computational virtual medium is the telephone. Now, we don't typically think of telephones as being a virtual technology, but what they essentially do is they allow us to talk to a person from which we're geographically distanced in a non-customary way. You know, what's technically going on is that the vibrations from our voice are being transduced into an electrical signal that is put down the wires and retransduced at the other end into a voice, or at least a sound. And this allows for a mode of communication or conversation that wasn't previously available. So it's the same function, but in a different medium. And I think that if we had the word virtual around, and it was in common parlance at the time that the telephone was created, that we might be tempted to use it at that point. And so I think this means that we can see that previous cultural developments, long past, were actually virtualizations or remediations of previous practices or functions. And so this is relevant to virtual reality headsets and, you know, the metaverse and my playing of Resident Evil, because we can see that what's being remediated there is our perceptual apparatus, the way that we engage with the world. So naturally, when we encounter the world, we do it through our senses, you know, our hearing and our vision, principally in terms of VR. And what VR does is it attempts to remediate our perceptual access to the world, so in a non-customary way, by using this type of very complex technology to allow us to perceive spaces around us. And these have different purposes and different functions. VR is not just used for fancy sort of fictional occasions like Resident Evil. It also has technical and non-fictive uses as well. So it can allow us to teach medical students how to perform operations, or it can actually aid in real operations by allowing surgeons to see what's going on as they're operating. It can allow sort of factual documentary, as I go into in the book, some examples of that. So it's not just a fictional technology. And I think that's another complication that's engendered by the, you know, the metaphysical approach to VR.
Well, I think you get to solve a lot of those problems in a moment, because I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about the art historical approach that you have taken to figuring out some of the perceptual and representational aspects of and picturing aspects of the virtual reality medium.
I think what I wanted to show that there is precedent for the intentions of the developers of VR headsets in previous sort of technological developments in the arts. And yeah, as I said, the intention of Alberti and Brunelleschi was to remediate our experience. I discuss an experiment that Brunelleschi carried out in Florence. It's quite a famous experiment. I won't go into the details here because it's a little bit complicated. But essentially, he used a mirror to show that you could compare a picture to the actual thing and to see how they sort of matched up geometrically. And so Alberti later codified this, and he came up with this thing called the plane and elevation method. And it allowed future artists to actually employ this technical method to produce geometrical spaces and linear perspective. And I think what they were trying to do basically was to reproduce our spatial experience of the world, even though there are lots of problems with this. And this led to a lot of argument in art history about whether it really does remediate our experience of the world. Mm-hmm. Famously, Nelson Goodman, a philosopher in the 20th century, argued that picturing isn't a remediation of our experience. It's more iconic or denotative or cultural, conventional. But nevertheless, they thought that they were remediating experience. And we can pick out a lot of other examples through art history of the attempt to remediate how our perceptual apparatus actually works when we experience a spatial scene. Another good example is how Da Vinci used shading, sort of desaturation and bluish shading of distant features and paintings like Virgin on the Rocks to give the impression of distance and visual scenes. And we can see that occurs in the natural perception of distant scenes also. So they were looking at how we actually perceive the world and try to reproduce that in paintings. So I think we can follow these trends in the development of art history and spatial depiction all the way through, up until the 20th century, when it becomes much more fractured, of course, because of abstract art becomes a principal concern of artists. But that we might see also VR as taking that back up again and, you know, sort of revivifying the attempt to allow for spatial depiction. And it actually solves many of the problems that we find in linear perspective. Mm. So the classic criticisms of linear perspective are that, well, you have to close one eye because it only provides one vantage point.
Yeah.
Your eye has to be perfectly static. It can't move around as it naturally does. And that if you look carefully at linear perspective pictures that use the plan and elevation method, they actually distort what we see. So at the very edges of the picture becomes very sort of unnaturally distorted.
Mm-hmm.
And there have also been empirical studies that show that people don't perceive pictures produced by that method to be particularly realistic anyway.
Yeah.
They prefer other ways of projecting space on a pictorial surface.
Well, it's certainly alluring to think that the Oculus Rift headset has its origins in the 15th century. There are, in fact, a couple of things that you note that have changed quite diametrically in the development of virtual reality of today as a picturing medium. And one of those is the egocentricity that VR offers.
Yeah, I think that another trend in the development of art was the position of the viewer in relation to the scene. And there are some famous paintings in which the painting seems to place the viewer within the picture space somehow, and it makes reference to them. So the Arnolfini Marriage would be a famous example of that, I guess, even though it's not in linear perspective, but it does give the impression that the viewer is looking onto the scene. There are a lot of examples of that style of thing, but the limitation on those is that if the viewer moves before the picture, the scene itself doesn't change geometrically to reflect that movement. Rather, it's static. So there's the famous effect of the eyes seeming to follow you when you move around a picture. Well, if the picture really did respond to your movement before it, the eyes wouldn't follow you because they would be fixated on the space that you previously occupied. Okay, so that's another limitation on that style of sort of spatial depiction. And I think that VR, because it takes up again this notion that we might realistically depict space, does better in many respects than static pictures produced by linear perspective, because now the viewer can move before the scene, apparently. The depiction of the scene will change given their particular perspective on the scene. And that's enabled by what are a couple of the key features of VR headsets. The key features of VR headsets that allow them to achieve this sort of egocentric mode of viewing is first, that picture that you're looking on is not static, but it is able to change given the viewpoint from which it's being viewed. And of course, this is a development that's allowed by computer graphics and the rendering of 3D graphics in particular. So there's some detail in the book about how this is achieved through polygonal modeling and basic computer graphics. So there's a thing called a virtual camera, which you can place in relationship to a 3D model, which is made up of various polygons. And the movement of this virtual camera changes the geometry of what's actually modeled. And so it gives the impression that there's a perspective moving on the pictured content. So that's one aspect of this. The second aspect is that the viewing position is defined by a stereoscopic headset. So there are two virtual cameras, in fact, and they're slightly displaced, representing each of the eyes of the viewer. And so you get a slightly different perception, a slightly different perspective on that modeled world that you're viewing. And this allows for various features of perception that actually in reality do give us the perception of spatial depth of the scene. And this is when things like Da Vinci stereopsis or convergence and accommodation, which are natural features of perception, which allow us to perceive space come in. And I think the final thing that virtual reality does is it allows us to interact with those objects that are actually depicted So it can represent as a model your hand and your hand reaching out into that modeled space and interacting with the objects you're finding there and changing them. Now, it's all a bit complicated. That gives a very broad view of what's going on. And there are lots of variations in the technology that achieves this. I think the basic lesson is that what VR headsets are attempting to do is to provide a sense of egocentric interactive picturing that moves beyond the sorts of static pictures that we find in museums and so forth.
So those two properties seem to allow for quite a lot to happen in virtual reality in comparison to other picturing media. And you bring up a bunch of examples that range from very familiar, like Microsoft Flight Simulator or aspects of telemedicine. But one thing that for me was quite telling and very illustrative is this experiment in which a subject was able to catch a ball which they only saw through a virtual reality headset while the ball was actually being thrown at them in reality. And the reason this stuck in my mind, taking us maybe already to the question of what is real in those situations, you might have seen in the news a couple of weeks ago, there was a news item about one of the multiverse's first sexual harassment complaint. Someone complained about having their breast stroked against their will upon looking down in the headset.
So there's a lot in that particular
well, let's try anyway.
So I'll talk a little bit more about the ball catching example, because that shows something interesting about virtual reality, the potential of it. So in that case, that's Disney research that's going on at the moment, and there are various other examples of that style of thing as well. So as you say, what happens is that the user is situated in a virtual reality environment, and aspects of that virtual reality environment are actually derived from their real environment. So a ball is tracked and it's thrown at them, and they're able to catch it, and with reasonable efficiency. And one thing that we might think that shows is that it's often thought that virtual reality cuts you off from the actual world. Mm. That one of the things that's often used to define virtual reality is that it excludes or pushes away your actual reality. But I don't think that's the case, because it can be used ways in which it allows you to see reality in augmented ways, or allows you to achieve things in reality that you might not be able to achieve otherwise. So in that case, it allows you to catch a ball, which is something we can all do. But there are other potential cases in which it might allow you to do things at a distance. So we could think about virtual prosthetics, or virtual prosthetic vision, allowing us to manipulate the world at a distance, and maybe have a robot proxy out there that we see through the perspective of, and that has appendages that we can control and can interact with things. And that would be interesting and useful in all sorts of circumstances, such as where it's more dangerous, obviously, to do things that we wouldn't want to do. Or, as I suspect, one of the big reasons that this technology is being developed, and it has military applications, obviously. Mm. We could pilot drones or control robots at a distance in a way that wasn't dangerous to our personal self. But this brings up another issue in the history of sort of philosophical assessment of pictures. Kendall Walton is a philosopher who's reasonably famous, and he has this claim that photographs of historical things actually allow us to see them. So if you imagine looking at a picture of your grandmother who has passed away on the wall, he thinks that when you look at that picture, you actually see your grandmother. Mm. And he calls this the idea of photographic transparency. Yeah. So when we look at photographs, we see things through them. And one of the claims I make in the book is that virtual reality might actually allow us to see things through them. So when we use a headset, it's not always that we're running from zombies in the world of Resident Evil. Sometimes we can actually see the world through that virtual reality headset, and this has applications. But I think, as you mentioned, it also has potentially worrying features.
Yeah.
The reason why virtual reality might be useful in a military sense is that it allows soldiers to do things that are dangerous in an actual context, but which would be perfectly safe for them in a virtual reality context. But this obviously brings a certain asymmetry into military combat. you might think it has moral ramifications, and that one side can be entirely virtual and the other side can be real, and this virtual army can sort of have this immoral asymmetry over their opponent combatants. And I think the example that you bring up as well is the worrying things that we might do in virtual reality if we're at a distance. And, you know, we, because of our distance from the person that we're interacting with, we can do things that, we wouldn't do if we had an actual connection with each other. So the sexual harassment or, you know, molesting or whatever, you know, those things are. You might think that for the similar reason to the military case that they would become possible in virtual reality. One of the deeper parts of the book is the question of what is being remediated in virtual reality. Are the actual objects themselves that we see being remediated, or is it our perceptual access to things that is being remediated? Mm-hmm. And this makes a big difference, I think. So I make the distinction when I discuss virtual reality and how it allows us to perceive things, that we need to think about the depiction itself and what it is that the depiction depicts. So the intentional object. So when you look at something within a virtual reality headset, often you are just looking or fictionally looking at a fictional thing. So Sometimes virtual reality headsets depict zombies and they aren't real.
Yeah.
And there don't seem to be the normal moral considerations for killing zombies as there might be for killing real things. So you have to be careful if you're going to morally assess interactions or events within virtual realities, whether the intentional object is real or whether it's something that's merely fictional. And I think the case of virtual harassment would be very sort of fraught with those, you know, those issues. They're quite difficult issues to solve. So is the avatar of a person within a virtual world actually the person that's controlling it?
Yeah.
Or is it, is it a controlled pictorial element? Is it something they're merely controlling? Mm-hmm. So do we have any sort of strict sense of identity with the things that we control in the world? When I look down at my hands in a virtual reality, are they really my hands? And when I shake hands with someone, am I really shaking their hands? Now, we're straying into metaphysics, which is something I really don't do hugely in the book.
Hmm. Well, let's try to stick with her for just one moment, if only to figure out why that's a bad idea. And a couple of things that came to mind that as I was reading your arguments in this area were the possibilities of understanding the construction of reality in virtual reality as something that's socially determined. And there's a couple of different ways to think about this. One, you mentioned the difference between the way that photography represents or brings about reality in one particular framing. One might contrast that with, say, a military application in which all sorts of social and ethical issues are coming up.
So I think I'm not claiming that virtual reality does not have real cultural implications or real social existence, or because I'm claiming basically the virtual reality is a fancy kind of picturing. Mm. And people have always done things with pictures, and there are always cultural standards and differentiations between different cultures and how pictures are used and so forth. And there is always a moral overlay in how pictures are used. So obviously I can draw offensive pictures, or I can draw a picture of an offensive thing and hand it to someone and thereby do something that's morally improper. I think technically what I'm saying is that we need to be careful about thinking that virtual reality objects that we encounter are actually real, or that they're remediated objects. Mm. I'm rather just claiming that virtual reality remediates perceptual processes and through picturing. And it's not something I really go into too much in the book, but that virtual reality does have a cultural inflection. One place in the book in which I come quite close to claiming that is in the discussion of virtual documentary, though I really didn't want to get into it because maybe it was too sort of culturally on the nose at the moment.
Mm.
There is one example that I discuss about how a virtual documentary might allow you to step into the shoes or the situation of someone who's experiencing segregation, United States during the 1960s or 50s, right? And the idea is in virtual documentary is often that they claim that you have this firsthand experience of what it's like to be in that situation. And I think that's really blunt and potentially obnoxious. I don't think there is a way that you can have a firsthand experience of what it was like to be a person in that time. And I think it would be obnoxious to claim that you could have that kind of experience, because virtual reality leaves out so much of what it would be like to have that. It's giving you this basic sort of, at the moment, what virtual reality gives you is the ability to see egocentric, stereoscopic visual spaces and audio spaces, but it gives nothing of the cultural expectations or the feelings or what it is like to be in that situation at that particular time with a cultural background. And that's one of my doubts about full virtual reality, that it could actually convince us that we're in some world that we're not currently in.
Well, I wonder how much this has to do with the hubris of technologists. And that brings me to think about Elon Musk and his pipe dream of Neuralink. That is the idea that we could all just be plugged into a machine that produces aesthetic experiences entirely bypassing the body and talking directly to our brains on the neurological level.
Oh, the book actually is quite skeptical. I started out studying VR and I was, pretty optimistic about its potential. The more and more I read about it and more philosophical literature that I read on it, I became more and more skeptical. There is so much literature making so many claims about the potential of VR to do all sorts of things that it's hard not to be sort of cynical about that. But I think there are also technical and theoretical constraints on whether VR could ever achieve this in the first place. There's all the technical stuff, VR is pretty crappy. Let's just put it that way at the moment. There's a field of vision, a constrained field of vision. You can often see outside of the VR headset. And I've never once been really confused that I was using a VR headset and not sort of looking at reality. Potentially these technical problems could be improved, and that they will be eventually. But there are also more sort of theoretical problems with VR, that it could ever virtualize reality to the full extent. At the moment, VR at most covers three or four sensory modalities, principally vision, hearing, a little bit of tactile stuff, but I'm sort of skeptical about a lot of that, and sort of movement as well, and a sense of movement, also proprioception. And it does that by, moving us around physically to give us the impression that we're really moving. Dark rides such as Harry Potter's journey in Universal Studios does that style of thing. But there are a lot more senses than just those that would need to be remediated for us to have this full virtual experience. We have internal senses. We have the sense of hunger. We have the sense of our heart beating. We have the sense of our stomach being distended. We have all sorts of senses that are internal to us that it's hard to work out how these would be remediated in any sort of physical way. Now, the obvious response to that is to say that we need to plug in. So forego the sensory surfaces themselves and just have some sort of immediate digital input into the brain to achieve, this virtualized world. But I think at the moment we just don't know whether that's possible. We can't assume that it is possible, because it seems, I think, to depend upon the idea that the mind is basically representational. Virtual reality is definitely representational, right? It's giving us representations. But what if the mind just doesn't work like that? What if it's not a representational thing? And there's this movement, sort of embodied cognition, which I don't talk too much about in the book. But that would seem to me to place sort of constraints on this idea that we could virtualize reality in that way. There's another problem as well, which I sort of explore in a sort of early way in the book. There is a problem with the idea that traditional pictures remediate our experience of reality. And this has to do with Nelson Goodman's idea that actually pictures are denotative and they're iconic. They don't reproduce reality. What they do is that they're sort of a language and we decode them given conventions. So we know what a picture in linear perspective depicts because we understand that convention. It doesn't really resemble reality, but we read into it what it's actually depicting. Now, virtual reality could be like that as well. Maybe it's iconic and maybe it's a conventional language and it doesn't reproduce reality at all. It just gives us enough to that we can understand what it's referring to, what it's representing and depicting. And I think there are some pretty good compelling examples that this might be going on in at least some cases of virtual reality, and particularly in tactile feedback. Mm. Tactile feedback at the moment is very rudimentary, and it doesn't seem to reproduce in any way feeling objects, picking up objects and so forth. What it does is it gives you an icon. You feel a little buzz in your hand from the buzzing controller, and you go, that means that I've encountered something in the world. So it's much more like reading off an experiment, an experience from like an icon. And that could even be the case in our visual experience as well. It could perfectly well be the case that what seems real to us, the stereoscopic experience of spatial environment, is really much more iconic than we realize.
Well, I think there's quite some evidence mounting to show that that might indeed be the case. I saw in the news only a few days ago, someone was trying to bring about smell-o-vision for the millionth time in the last 20 or 30 years, as far as I'm aware. We have been able to produce and put 3D television in the home for something like 20 years, but the demand just simply isn't there. So I guess this brings about the question of whether a degree of realism or fidelity in what we accept as virtual reality is in fact the goal of all these technologies.
I think that the case, another assumption in the VR literature is that, this is relates to what you just said, is that realism is the goal, the you know, unavoidable aim of VR. And I just don't think that's inherent in the technology at all, that there are lots of uses, as there are in normal picturing, that don't even attempt to produce realistic depiction. And I think we might find ourselves 20 years down the track, if VR turns out to be more than a gimmick, of people exploiting in all sorts of non-realistic ways, achieving all sorts of things which you don't envisage now, which isn't the mere replication of a realistic environment. This connects with, there's a philosopher, Nick Bostrom, who people might be aware of, mm-hmm. who thinks potentially that this is a virtual reality that we're currently living in now. And he gives an argument for this, which involves a bit of dubious statistics and some anthropomorphic sort of assumptions about our existence. But one of the assumptions is that any civilization that discovers virtual reality will use it to depict realistic situations of the past so that we can experience them again. And I think that's just a wild assumption that we have no reason to make.
Well, talking about wild assumptions, maybe this is a good moment to think a little bit about art's relationship with VR. I'm thinking from a perspective of the visual arts, in which things are both kind of happening and not happening. There is a bunch of artists, including people like John Ruffman, who have been quite popular and quite successful using some early applications of virtual reality technologies. I guess some of their work has been sort of fetishized for the technical novelty of what it does. But I think we also have a situation in which there is a little bit of lack of definition to the medium and virtual reality as something that artists should address on the same terms that other media might have been processed by them. And there's a bigger thing that has been on my mind lately, again from the news, when Mark Zuckerberg announced the launch or the prospect of the metaverse, he made quite plentiful use of quite banal looking examples of art. And as the critic Dean Kissick commented on, it seems to me that the technologists don't really understand what the metaverse or the next generation of virtual reality experiences might actually mean for aesthetic applications. And that leads me to wonder about the kind of dance in which artists and technologists try to figure each other out.
Yeah, well, I'm not an artist, and, I'm a philosopher of the arts, but that's sort of a bit of a fudge. I really talk about video games and and that style of thing. But
well, I think video games are completely for game in this question. So.
Well, I don't think we really understand the nature of performance or the audience-performer relationship or what's being experienced when you experience a video game or a virtual artwork at the moment. And I think that's we tend to treat it as a way of remediating, you know, in a very superficial way, things that have already been achieved in non-virtual reality, which is what might be that you might be referring to. But I think the potential for virtual reality is in the kind of art practices carried out within a virtual reality space, you know, performance in the space itself, and how that might connect you to other people or to audiences, or how audiences might react to and interact with artists within that virtual space, rather than just creating sort of fancy 3D pictures. I think that might be the real potential for virtual reality art. But, you know, I can't imagine what artists will do, but VR headsets are so available now. I just, everywhere I see people buying the new Oculus Quest 2, right? And that just prevalence of this medium is going to make changes, I'm sure.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't actually met anyone who has a headset on the bookshelf, let alone the head. But the maker has certainly seen a lot of interest in remediating certain artistic experiences into, at the very least, televisual platforms.
I think my immediate social circles are probably pretty selective, I guess. So it might be might be biased, but I think it actually is turning the corner a little bit, and it's becoming a little less gimmicky. So personally, I recently got the Oculus Quest 2, and it's such a step ahead in comfort. And you know, the problem with early headsets is they were so bulky and they were tethered to things, and they're a pain. They produced a lot of because of the latency in the images, they produced a lot of sort of VR sickness. But the Oculus Quest 2 is actually, it's just fantastic in all those regards. And I don't mind using it. In fact, I'd prefer to use it to play some games than looking at a 2D screen.
Oh, wow. That's the biggest smile you've had during our conversation so far. So we're definitely turning around some of the earlier skepticism. And I know it might be a bad idea to speculate, but I'd like to ask you to try to do that anyhow. What is next for VR?
I think there is a positive potential in VR. Now, I've been trapped at the bottom of the world in New Zealand for the last 2 years, not being able to travel overseas or to go to conferences. And the conferences I have attended have been on a screen in front of me in Zoom, which is not ideal for interacting with groups of people. And I think VR could solve a lot of those issues. If I interacted with, you know, people around me in a VR space, I could see their gestures, I could react to them and respond to them and feel their presence, co-presence around me. You know, that'd be a positive thing. I think that technical ability to place people together in a virtual space could be exploited in lots of interesting and, you know, healthy ways, I think, as well. But we'd have to remember, of course, that there are limitations on that. Maybe it's not entirely real, and there are dangers as well in what's going on there. I see that as, you know, a positive thing, a positive development. Whether that solves any sort of our ecological problems with flying to conferences overseas, because, of course, there is still a lot of wastage and resources used to back up the computational systems that, you know, are used in VR. I'm not sure, but I think... Surely a positive, not having to fly to North America if you want to meet your colleagues.
I mean, I'd quite like to fly to North America today. Why not? But I completely understand. And is this is a research topic that you're going to stick with? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book on our retreat into imaginary worlds, which is related to this, but it's also a little bit more political. And you know, why are people retreating into imaginary worlds so often, such as board games or role-playing games or VR video games? And what does that reflect about their experience of how we've managed to set our current world up? And is it a good or a bad thing that we're spending so much time in imaginary worlds?
Well, please do come back and tell us all about it when it's out. Grant, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. Great.
The Aesthetics of Virtual Reality by Grant Tavener is published by Routledge. I'm Pierre de Lance, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.